I'm going to call the meeting to order. Call the meeting of the Conference Committee on Senate File 958 to order. This meeting will be held in accordance with House Rule 10.01. Just an overview of what we hope to accomplish today. But many thanks to staff for the walkthrough yesterday and those who testified and submitted testimony. Today, we're going to start to build the conference committee report, even though it will be in small steps in adopting same and similar language. Aside from that, I thought it'd be good to review the provisions that we are close with and then provide the Senate with an opportunity to hear about a couple of the House-only provisions, and please ask questions if you have them. Any questions from or comments from Senator Western before we get started? I understand he's delayed a little bit, but he'll be joining us shortly then. Okay, the list of the same and similar different provisions was posted, and that's what we're going to be working from, along with the side-by-sides. Mr. Sullivan, could you walk us through the provisions, and then we'll entertain motions after each.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members. There are two items in the same or similar category. The first has to do with the Good Food Access Program, and the language is on pages R23 and R24 of the side-by-side. It starts at the bottom of R23, it's Senate Section 2 and House Section 6. The bold section header language reads, qualifications for receipt of financing and other financial or technical assistance. This was a provision that was recommended by the governor, picked up by both the House and the Senate. It eliminates a requirement for a Good Food Access Program recipients to apply for and accept WIC benefits. The House language also fixes a cross-reference later in the section. It's on line 22.2 of the House language. And it would be my recommendation, Mr. Chair, that the conferees adopt House Section 6, lines 21.1 through 22.7 on the side-by-side.
Okay. Do we need a motion on that, or what do we need to do there, Nancy?
Representative Sundin, if you just want to move the House language.
Okay. I'll move the House language. Any discussion on this? Okay. All those in favor of approval of the House language as stated, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, say nay, please. Okay, that motion prevails. Our first provision is adopted. Next up, we have the bio-incentive program, the biomass sourcing plan exemptions. Is there any comments on that from staff?
Mr. Chair and members, this is Colby. Just to note that these provisions are identical between the House and Senate, so the conferees could adopt either or one from each.
Okay, is Senator Westrom available yet?
Mr. Chair?
Good morning, Senator Murphy.
Good morning, Chair Sundin. It is good to see you. I am just asking where that provision is in the side-by-sides, please.
That'd be R35, R37.
Thank you.
Give you a minute to digest this. Do you have any questions on that, Senator Murphy?
Chair Sundin, I do not have any questions.
Okay. Thank you. Well, in that case, Senator Murphy, would you like to move the Senate position?
Chair Sundin, I would move Section 14 on page R35.
Okay. Any discussion to that motion? Okay, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Okay, opposed say nay, please. Okay, hearing none, the motion prevails. That's it for the same and similar. Is that it from Mr. Sullivan?
Mr. Chair and members, there's one more section in the bio incentive same area, and that's on page R37. It would be Senate Section 15 and House Section 24. Those are also identical. It's a corresponding change to the renewable chemical component of the bioincentive program.
Mr. Chair, I would move Section 24 on page R37 of the House language.
Okay, thank you, Senator Murphy. You have heard the motion. Any discussion? All those in favor say aye, please.
Aye.
Opposed, nay? Hearing none, the motion prevails. Thank you, Mr. Sullivan. Thank you, Senator Murphy. Yeah, we can entertain an overview of the similar House and Senate provisions. This is for discussion only at this point. The next three items are provisions that are in both bills and maybe close to coming to agreement. I thought it might be helpful to get a brief overview of these issues that are outstanding and some possible solutions that we can discuss. So hopefully we can take action on these in the coming days. So first up would be the cottage food licensing changes. They can be referenced on R31 through 33. We had about 10 minutes to talk about this. Presenting the information would be Representative Samantha Vang and Catherine Simon of the Food and Feed Safety Division Director. Go ahead, Representative Vang.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. So I carry the cottage food language here in the House side with Senator Matthews on the Senate side. So just a brief background about cottage food. Cottage food producers, they sell homemade, shelf-stable like bread, cookies, and jams. They sell their food direct to consumer and at farmers markets and community events. The food that they sell is very safe. It's required by law to not be not potentially hazardous. Minnesota's cottage food industry has grown in recent years. In 2020, there were more than 5,000 cottage food producers in the state. And therefore, you know, cottage food helps farmers and creates jobs, especially in rural communities and small towns. Many people sell cottage food to provide for their families and to start and grow their own businesses. During the pandemic, selling cottage food has also provided a lifeline for Minnesotans who are out of work. And so many of the provisions I work with Senator Matthews and advocates we agree on, such as raising the $18,000 gross caps to $78,000 so producers can earn a living wage, allows producers to organize their businesses, codifies the Minnesota Department of Ag policy on allowing cottage food producers to provide for their business address on their products to protect producers and safety. There are some slight differences, some on the streamlining training requirements on all registrants rather than separating tier one and tier two to different trainings, and adjust inflation language on the sales cap, and those are the slight differences that we see on the side by side. And with that, I can defer the rest of the testimony to Director Simon, who oversees this program.
Director Simon, would you please identify yourself and continue with the presentation?
Good morning. My name is Catherine Simon with the Minnesota Department of Agriculture. I'm the director of the Food and Feed Safety Program. For the cottage food program, it is an exemption from licensing that we administer. So I think from the side-by-side, the other item that we have to call out is the right now there's a reduction in the fee in both. I'm from $50 down to $25. That is paid by the tier two. Those funds go towards the administration of the program, the registration process, but it also goes towards the training information that the agency provides, as well as the basic information and resources that we provide to those cottage food producers when they're trying to seek out whether they need registration process or whether they need to move into the licensing process with the agency. So our desire is to have sort of consistency and clarity in the language as it goes forward. And so with that, if the inflation information is included, it would be best if that is consistent between the tier one and tier two, if those are moving forward. But beyond that, I'm available for questions.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Representative Vang, you, I understand you're close on this then from your testimony. Who are you working with in the Senate on this project?
Mr. Chair, I was working with Senator Matthews. I've reached out to him on amendment language. I haven't gotten a response back, so that is pending for now.
Okay. Well, thank you for your work on that. Hopefully we can get a response from the senator and get this one off the table here in the next meeting or so. Appreciate your work on this. Okay. Anything further on the cottage foods?
Questions? Mr. Chair.
Questions?
Mr. Chair.
Oh.
Tory here.
Oh. Good morning, Senator.
Good morning. Just, it seems like we're fairly close on these. Seems like we're fairly close on this, so we might as well move on, but it might be a topic that we, I know you and I need to talk later this morning and or afternoon, so we could just touch base on this, and maybe there's some ideas we could try to exchange back and forth to keep moving forward.
Okay, I'm welcome to that. I will be available, and I'll be consulting with Representative Bang on anything we do. So, thank you.
Sounds good.
Next up, we have the wild game processing licensing exemption. You'll find information on that page 30 and 31. There's a desire from the native tribes to add wait a second, no, this is a different one. The licensing exemptions would provide a cutoff point. We've got similar language here. The Senate's language reads, a person who processes non-inspected meat from game animals, as that term is defined in Minnesota rules, for the owner of the carcass and who returns the meat products derived from the processing to the owner, if the person does not engage in processing for more than a 90-day period or calendar year. There's a little bit of difference here. We've got language here that provides thresholds, and we're talking about thresholds of animals or total gross receipts. So I think we're pretty close on this as well. I think we can find an answer to this one quite easily if you want to make that part of our discussions as well, Senator. And maybe we can come to terms on that as well. So any input on the game processing? Any comments at this point from committee members?
Mr. Chair, I would concur with you that I think we're extremely close on this as well. And one of the issues is sometimes putting a dollar amount in rather than days is eventually inflation changes that number so much 10, 20 years down the road. So maybe we could just talk about the days, if perhaps a few days less would be more amenable, but let's talk about that as well, because I think we're both in the same ballpark. So
yeah, okay, yeah, you know, my concerns on that would be, you know, we have numbers of animals that could be processed, you know, that's where the days doesn't really fit. If somebody's got an operation that's only open for 60 days, but he's processing thousands of animals, then he should be regulated rather than just turned loose. And that's pretty much the intent of this language anyway, is just to let the small processors conduct business as they normally would without any registration or certifications, excuse me. So yeah, I think we can talk about this. Hopefully next meeting or the next two meetings, we can have a resolution to this.
Sounds good to me.
Okay. Thank you. Any input from the committee on this? I don't hear any now.
Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson has his hand up and Dr. Kneser is also available.
Oh, okay. Representative Nelson, please.
Yeah, I think this language is, thank you, Mr. Chair, and I think this language is, you know, fairly close between the two sides, and I think to Senator Westrom's point, you know, putting a dollar figure in there, you know, inflation changes things, and so, and to your point, a number of animals, and so I think maybe if we put in, they're exempt up to a certain number of animals, and I think that makes more sense than anything as labor rates change and everything. You know, I think having a cap of, you know, if it was 200 animals or something like that, I think that maybe makes more sense than if we put a dollar cap on there. Then we don't have to come back to the legislature every few years and adjust the dollar amount.
Okay, thank you. Any further comments? Nicole Kneser from the Meat and Dairy Inspection Division, any comments on this?
Yeah, thank you, Chair Sundin. Nicole Kneser, Director of the Dairy and Meat Inspection Division. I would say that I agree, we're very close on this. And I think from our perspective, the reason that MDA would support a dollar limit and an animal count would be to keep in mind that this exemption is not just about deer. There's also other kinds of wild game that are processed. And so it's very difficult to say, well, 200 animals means a lot different thing if we're talking about pheasants versus deer. And so I believe that we've sent some compromise language that would encompass both a dollar amount and an animal limit so that deer processors would get some relief, I guess, from inflation and could continue to process at their current levels over time, as well as to accommodate processors that are doing other species. So, and I'm open for questions if there are any.
Okay, well, thank you. Just, I'm sure you'd be available if we have questions as we continue these discussions. So, thank you much. Any other comments on the game processing? Okay, thank you. We'll move on to the hand sanitizer issue. You'll find that reference on page 27 of your handouts here. Okay, we have Assistant Commissioner Whitney Place with comments on the hand sanitizer.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Whitney Place. I'm Assistant Commissioner at FDA. We exempted a license category for application of disinfectants and sanitizers when COVID-19 arose. We did not exempt any of our current licensees, only future licensees that would come from applying products as related to COVID. We asked for an extension for a year for these applications as COVID is still happening and as we try to figure out how we regulate this new category of products and new applicators. And so the Department of Agriculture would like to propose the House language in this bill to continue that extension. And I also have Roger McAdams, who runs our pesticide applicator licensing program at the department, to answer any more questions or to get into more specifics.
Okay, any questions on this issue from the committee? I do. I'm just wondering about, you know, whatever's in these hand sanitizers that can actually be dangerous for people that are exposed to them on a daily basis. I don't understand specifically what dangers exist for people that are handling these.
Roger, would you want to explain why we have our licensure program for some of these products?
Sure. Thank you, Representative Sundin. I'm Roger McAdams. I'm Assistant Director of the Pesticide and Fertilizer Management Division, oversee the regulatory and licensing area. One quick clarification. This does not have to do with hand sanitizers. Hand sanitizers are regulated by the FDA. This has to do with sanitizers and disinfectants for cleaning of hard surfaces or disinfecting of hard surfaces. Currently, the commercial use of those, meaning the for hire application of those, would have to be licensed in the state of Minnesota by the current regulation. Last year, we came forward and requested an exemption for those companies doing that type of work for COVID-19 response to be exempted. That was put in the legislative statute at that point to give a year. We're asking for it to be extended another year. And the reason for that is currently our antimicrobial category that deals with the folks that do the commercial application of sanitizers and disinfectants is a category that's focused on mold, HVAC systems, cooling tower systems, which we believe is a very important category. We don't believe that we should eliminate that category, but we're still trying to evaluate, is the need to have the folks that are doing the hard surface application for hire due to COVID a need to have a category? And at this point in time, they would have to fall under the antimicrobial category. That exam, that training is very focused on mold, mildew, HVAC systems. Doesn't really apply to the type of applications that's happening due to COVID. We believe an exemption is warranted because for the most part, they use general use products, same things the homeowner use, but they are doing that commercial application. And we would like to have that year so that we can evaluate with the folks from the university, Department of Health, industry groups, to see if this is an industry that's going to continue. It's obviously continuing through the pandemic, but we don't know if it's going to be something that we really even need a license for down the road. And if we do need a license, we need a different category because the true antimicrobial category, as I said, is focused on those HVAC mold treatment, which the legislature requested us to review back in 2007. We did that and created that category. So I hope that clarifies things a little bit, Chair Sundin. It doesn't necessarily answer your question, but it clarifies what this bill is about.
Sure. Thank you. That's helpful. You know, I draw on my experience in the workforce where I handled a lot of toxic, caustic, dangerous chemicals and substances, and you know, I worry about the worker handling these, and that's my primary concern. You know, so I see Senator Murphy's got her hand up first.
Thank you, Chair Sundin, and members. I was the author of the legislation to extend the sunset, and we had a debate about whether or not we extend the sunset or if we eliminate the regulatory framework more generally, which is what the committee decided to do in this bill. I will say that the Department of Ag has been steadfast in their opposition to this change in the regulatory framework. And while we had a debate about it in the committee, we didn't really get a lot of public testimony. In fact, I don't think there was any public testimony. And so this is a change as Ms. Place is describing, but not one that has been really vetted with the public. So I just want to make sure, as the author of the language to extend the sunset, that I am sharing with you what we discussed in the committee. It was a good tussle between Chair Westrum and myself, and one that this committee is going to have to wrestle with. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Chair Westrum, please.
Mr. Chair, and to the comments from Roger, just maybe to drill down a little bit closer on that, because this is, you know, product sold on the off the shelf that people use daily or cleaning common cleaning agents, and so prior to 2007 there was no licensing requirement. So this is a relatively new. There's been very few complaints, none that I recall in the last year since we exempted this for COVID already. But Roger, could you just talk a little bit more? It seems to me that, and you mentioned that the category about HVACs, and you're talking kind of commercial systems as opposed to somebody coming in and selling, or using these products to clean down offices or restaurants for COVID or other types of sanitary. There's kind of a distinguishing difference here. Can you just talk about that categorical HVAC system? And that seems to me to be a much more focused, larger system microbial issue than this, what seems to be a pretty broad brush otherwise. So can you help me understand that a little better?
Mr. Chair and Chair Westrum, yeah, I can expand a little bit, and that's where some of the department's concern is, in that the antimicrobial category, as it currently sits, was focused on and is still focused on those folks that are treating HVAC systems, maybe in residential areas, maybe in commercial buildings, or treatment of mold due to remediation from moisture, flooding, what have you. Again, could be a commercial setting, could be a residential setting. But because those products are also distinguished as sanitizers and disinfectants, if the statute gets to the point where all applications of sanitizers and disinfectants for hire don't need a license, then that would exempt all those other traditional antimicrobial categories, which we believe still are in a need of training, are in a need of a licensure system, because as those companies go into those either residential or commercial areas, by having that license, they have to have insurance, they have to have training. So we think that is very important that we continue to do that. In response to the COVID applications, Senator Westrum, I think you've alluded to some of the wiping down or the hard surface cleaning. It's sort of a different application. We still are trying to evaluate, is that a concern going forward? At this point in time, we're trying to pull industry folks together and try and make that determination if that is a category. There have been concerns across the country in regard to some of these applications possibly done by non-licensed folks. We have not had any in the state of Minnesota. So we're still trying to evaluate that. That's why the department supports the House language, which exempts that COVID type applications for another year while we try and figure that out. But it doesn't interrupt the antimicrobial category that has been in place since 2007. And I think, you know, in talking to some of the structural applicators that are out there, they are also concerned about getting companies inside of these businesses that aren't licensed. Will they start applying some of the other products and things like that? So I think there are some concerns from other industries to just wholeheartedly exempt the use of sanitizers and disinfectants, because that means more than just, you know, the stuff that you and I would buy on the shelf to treat our own hard surfaces.
Okay. Thank you. Anything further, Senator Westrum?
Mr. Chair and Roger, I'll go back, but I mean, we're going off of the facts you gave us a year ago when we extended this exemption. So as I recall it, your facts indicated it was stuff that was common store or shelf purchases. maybe you had put a caveat in place that it was other stuff that you just alluded to, but that's the first time I recall you guys indicating that it was not the store off the store shelf a purchase. But I'll go back to your notes from a year ago, because that's what you brought to the legislature when we exempted it. But I am wondering if the category, the bigger category, it sounds like your training focuses on the HVAC and the mold and not the surface cleaning and the COVID. So it does seem overly broad. And before 07, what did we do for the people that did mold treatment prior to 07? The state, can you elaborate on that?
Mr. Chair and Chair Westrom, prior to 07, there was not a category for the antimicrobial. Complaints okay. came forward to us, came forward to you. That's why the legislature wanted us to expand, evaluate, should there be a category for those types of systems. We did that. When we came to you last year, we did say that the stuff that are being used for COVID type applications is mainly the stuff that's on the shelf, and that's why we believed it was an exemption. But it was specific to those COVID applications. It wasn't to the entire antimicrobial category.
So last question right now, Mr. Chair, but Roger, what would you say, breaking out the category of the antimicrobial and the HVAC systems that you're talking about, is that 95% of the people we're talking that are exempt now, or is it 10%? What indication are we?
Senator Westrom, thank you for that question. That's part of our uncertainty. We don't know how many people are going to be in this business. You know, COVID came around last year. We were responding to a pandemic. It's really hard to say how many types of businesses are going to get into this type of work as we go back to business as usual, whatever that means. We don't know how big that category is, or if this is going to be a type of commercial application that's going to continue down the road. That's part of the reason for interested in another year exemption as we try and figure this out for the COVID applications.
Senator Westrom. So, Roger, prior to a year ago, do you have how many were you talking? How many were licensed prior to COVID? Do you recall offhand a few hundred, a few thousand? I guess that would just be insightful.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Senator Westrom, the antimicrobial category actually has about a dozen companies that are licensed with about 30 to 35 applicators from one year to next. That's the focus on the HVACs and all those other. There, we didn't have anybody licensed to do the types of applications for COVID because I don't think it was occurring out there prior to this. And right now, the exemption was in place through April 1st. Nobody has come forward to get licensed in that category. And that's what we're trying to figure out, is how many companies are there out there that are doing this type of application.
So, Ms. Roger, it was about 30, 35 generally licensed before COVID, if I heard you right. Is that right?
Mr. McInnes?
Mr. Chair, Senator Westrom, you are correct.
Okay, thank you. No further questions at this time, Mr. Chair, but I guess I'll just make some comments. And Senator Murphy's right, we kind of tussled back and forth. One of the bills that we did hear was a permanent extension or permanent exemption for the COVID response, which a few people have offered that bill as well. I think Senator Murphy's originally had that language in there as well. From what Roger's saying, it does sound like that's for sure a different type of application, and maybe a scenario where we look at harder there as well. But let's continue to discuss this.
If I may ask, Senator, is there any additional information you and possibly Senator Murphy could gather and come forward with a proposal that would be acceptable?
Sure. I guess to my questioning, and maybe Roger, if there's a way to give us some information that what would if you broke out the antimicrobial mold application, I want to go back and look at the notes that what the department had given us a year ago, but it does sound like maybe that bigger commercial application of an HVAC system in either a high-rise apartment building or a commercial application might be, a category that Roger's talking about that maybe is a different, much bigger scope or bigger impact than the smaller cleaning that we're largely talking about otherwise. So anything on that, Roger, you could get us, I think would be helpful.
That's terrific. I know as a chair of this committee, it's not my duty to assign homework, but if Senator Westrom and Senator Murphy and the professionals involved can bring something forward in the next couple of days, that'd be terrific. So thank you for your work.
I'm happy to pitch in.
Thank you. Okay. Is that it for now with the hand sanitizer, as it's labeled, hand sanitizer? Any other comments on this? Yeah. All right, thank you. Thank you much. We've got some overviews of the House-only provisions. This is for discussion purposes only. We heard testimony on some of these issues yesterday. It's not my intention to rehear each issue, but instead provide some overview technical information, if you please, to lay a foundation and provide opportunity for the Senate to ask questions if they choose. So we have Commissioner Peterson, Deputy Commissioner Vobel will be able to jump in. So first up would be the cooperative reauthorization. If you can refer to page 22 and 23, we can talk about this for a few minutes. Representative Vang and company can talk about this. So Representative Vang, you want to lead off the discussion on this cooperative reauthorization?
Thank
page,
you, Mr. Chair.
Page
22
and 23 of your...
That's cool. That's correct. Mr. Chair, members, I carried the House language for the cooperative bill reauthorization. I think this is something that both sides can come to an agreement and find support in. There is no Senate language, and so I'll just introduce the House language. What this bill does is it reauthorizes MDA to make grants to help producers develop cooperatives to process and market Minnesota-grown agricultural products. This language mirrors a program that used to be in statute at MDA. It's timely, and it's important that we bring this program back for two reasons. First, because Minnesota farmers are growing new and often high-value crops for which the market and supply chain is still emerging. Producer-led cooperatives can help these producers develop the processing and marketing infrastructure needed to grow the market for these crops. I also work with producers who are growing hemp, for example. A key challenge for them is to find processing. If these farmers had support to form cooperatives, they could come together and build some of that processing capacity for themselves. This value-added work can also help producers earn more money for their products. The second reason is cooperative development is timely because many producers are becoming frustrated, consolidating in our food system and want to build alternative models. So this is particularly true in the wake of COVID-19. Cooperatives are an important tool that producers can use to build alternative markets for the farm products. The lack of local meat processing, for example, has been raised in this committee. I know there are local producers who are thinking about ways they could start cooperatively owned slaughter facilities. And finally, you'll notice this bill does not have a dollar amount attached to it. And that's because the Agri program already supports important work. And it's not my intention to take away from that. Instead, this leaves the funding up to the commissioner in case money becomes available. And my hope is that if federal money becomes available for economic recovery, we could direct some of it through this program. And so once again, this cooperative development is a tool we can use to help Minnesota producers innovate and build new models that better serve our farm business and communities. And with that, I can defer the rest of the testimony to Commissioner Peterson, who can talk in support of this policy, as well as Mr. Hughinen from the Ag and Marketing Development Division Director.
Thank you, Representative Fang. Commissioner Peterson, you have comments for us?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Again, Tom Peterson, Commissioner of Agriculture, Minnesota Department of Agriculture. And I want to thank Vice Chair Bang for bringing this piece forward. It wasn't in our bill language, but it's something that I, have worked on for many years. As Vice Chair Bang said, this was a piece that the department used to have. And I hate to use one of my things that I don't like to use, but this would be a nice tool in the toolbox for the department to have. We see this come up quite often, actually, and I think I would be very interested to see with markets developing on a lot of different cases, whether it's edible beans, peppers, hemp, as the vice chair said. We just had a Kernza co-op. There's quite a broad spectrum of co-ops, especially looking at Identity Preserve might be shipping to other countries. There's a lot of good stuff here, and this would be helpful. But I also have Paul Hughinen, as you said, and I'll turn it over to Paul maybe for some comments. Paul?
Mr. Hughinen, please.
Sure. Good morning, Mr. Chair, members. My name is Paul Hughinen. I'm the Director of the Ag Marketing and Development Division. Just a note about the legislation. It does provide a unique kind of authority for the department and work with farmers who would get together and form a co-op. And it would allow the department to help them with some of the things that are really difficult for farmers to find capital for. And that's feasibility studies, marketing plans, those kinds of efforts that take place before they can invest in buying a facility. So we think it's timely. You know, whether you look at farmers wanting to potentially go together and do meat processing, maybe a mobile slaughter unit, hemp certainly provides that opportunity. We think it's especially important in new market development to encourage farmers to go together and own their own processing equipment as a co-op. With that, happy to answer any questions.
Any questions for the testifiers?
Yeah, Mr. Chair.
Senator
Wester,
please.
Paul or Commissioner, currently, what would restrict value-added grants from being able to use for this or the new market development money? And then wrapped into that question, is this, what would this money actually be used for, I guess? And why wouldn't those funds already work for something like
that? Go ahead, Paul.
Sure, Mr. Chair, and members. So with the value-added grants, we would have the ability to do things like feasibility studies. We're limited primarily by the amount of money that would be available for that. And so with agri and value-added grants, we've really focused on the equipment part of it. What's unique about this legislation is it would allow future funding, if the legislature so decided to do that, to be targeted to farmer-owned cooperatives specifically. Whereas value-added grants, farmer-owned cooperatives are eligible, but certainly the vast majority of the participants in that program are traditional corporations that are not necessarily owned by farmers.
So, Mr. Chair,
Senator Westrum, please.
Go ahead, Paul. I didn't mean to.
No, I think I was just going to wrap up. I think I answered your question, but let me know if I missed a piece.
Senator Westrum.
So, Mr. Chair, these would be this language or co-op money would be one of the conditions would be you'd have to be farmer owned, so it'd be strictly to kind of help somebody that's engaged in an aspect of farming to basically help market their products or add value in some way as a farmer.
Mr. Chair, Senator Westrum, yes, that's exactly right. That is the unique part of this is it's limited to cooperatives that would be 100% of the equity would be owned by farmers. And it would allow us to target specifically, you know, farmers as owning their own value-added processing. Eligible activities include things like, you know, market studies, feasibility studies. You know, if they were interested in building or buying a facility, it would allow them to do kind of that pre-design work on facilities. So it is a rather unique set of permissible activities. And the primary unique part of this is that it would allow us to do a grant program specifically for farmers who were owning their own cooperatives.
Okay,
very good. And the last question, what amounts are you thinking? Would there be a limit on the amounts, or what kind of money would it generally take for these efforts to advance forward? And I guess wrapped in that, is there some scenarios where they do a study and then find out it's probably not a viable option? So after the money's gone to that, nothing might materialize?
Mr. Huguenin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Senator Westrum. Yeah, that's perfect questions. And the legislation lists $50,000. Yeah, grants up to $50,000 to eligible grantees. And to the answer to the second part of your question about is it possible that they would do preliminary research and decide not to make an investment? Definitely. And you know, while that certainly isn't the goal, is to, you know, invest money in research and come up with a no-go. We would much rather have farmers do due diligence and do their homework and then come up with the decision to say, you know what, this either isn't the right idea or it's not the right time. Let's not invest millions of dollars in a new processing plant. So there, even if the answer at the end of it is no, that's a potentially positive outcome. But certainly the goal is to set the stage for farmers to have profitable value-added businesses.
Very good. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator. Thank you, Mr. Huguenin. And Senator Andersons.
Good morning. Thank you, Chair. This question is probably for the commissioner or maybe Representative Vang, because she mentioned in her earlier testimony that this language used to be in statute and has been taken out. And I'm just wondering, when was that language in there and what was the reason for taking it out?
Who could best answer that question?
Mr. Chairman?
Commissioner Peterson, please.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Anderson, it was taken out. I believe it was used to be funded, and then during a deficit probably almost 16, 17 years ago, if I recall, the program was cut due to budget shortfall. I believe it was the 2003 legislature, and then the department chose not to fund it at that time. But I recall because I was involved in it too. We did do, or the department did do quite a few grants to co-ops to support it. But it was I believe 2003 when we had the $6 billion deficit. So at that point, and then it was just never picked back up.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator Anderson.
Commissioner, it says in here that the commissioner may receive applications and make grants up to $50,000 to eligible grantees for feasibility. How many grants are you talking about? Because I don't remember talking or hearing anything about a set amount of money to be set aside to meet, say, one grant, let alone maybe more.
Commissioner Peterson, please.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Anderson. To me, this looks like very permissive language. That's what the good piece about Agri is right now, with some flexibility built in. I think we would assess the situation. There isn't dollars allocated to it at this moment. And so I'd maybe ask Mr. Huguenin, who runs the grant program, too, just to expound on that a little bit.
Mr. Huguenin, do you have comments?
Sure, Mr. Chair, members. As was pointed out, there is no appropriation that goes with this language, but it allows the department to create a program specifically for farmer-owned cooperatives. So, for example, if we were to be able to access federal grant money for this purpose, it would give us the authority to issue those grants. And so that's the value of the language, is it gives us the authority. And if we can find funds outside of the state budgeting system, that becomes a good opportunity. Or if bodies like this choose to apply funding to it in the future, the authorization is there.
Follow-up question.
Senator Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Maybe Ms. Vang's got an idea regarding this here, as far as how many groups or aspiring farmers have come to her or come to you, Mr. Huguenin or Commissioner, asking for an opportunity to be involved with some expansion of or looking into the opportunity to become a cooperative.
Is that a question to Representative Vang?
Either of the three.
Okay, Senator Anderson shotgunning here. So we'll start off with Representative Vang. If we can.
Kill three birds with one stone, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Senator Anderson, for your question. I've been approached by Minnesota Farmers Union regarding this policy bill, and as well as I have a couple hemp cooperatives that are also emerging who are interested in this proposal too as well.
Okay, thank you. I understand Commissioner Peterson had a response.
Mr. Chairman and Senator, great question. And, you know, anecdotally, you know, I named some of them earlier. I'm very excited about this because I think Vice Chair Vang brought up in her testimony, you know, COVID really brought in a lot of different things, you know, people thinking about unique marketing skills and everything. And so we have seen hemp especially, because we haven't had big players come in. You know, keep in mind, Minnesota has always been a leading co-op state. We're home to the biggest co-ops, you know, across the country. And so I think continuing to support that, but hemp especially, where we don't have, but also a lot of these specialty crops that are just coming on, whether it's elderberries or kernza, you know, very good. But I also mentioned like specialty beans, you know, going to other places, a lot of different varieties of types of agriculture. You know, we have interest in co-ops and co-ops forming, and we work with different co-op associations that help develop them. And I think it gives Minnesota, would give Minnesota an advantage in starting some of those co-ops. So I think it's, we also have other commodity co-ops such as meat, you know, meat processing and meat sales, things like that. So I think this is, it's hard to say how much interest there would be, but I can tell you as commissioner, we have conversations quite regularly with our parties about this.
Now, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Senator Anderson, please.
Thank you. Commissioner, do you know, or maybe Mr. Huguenin, do you know if this language is being used in other states, and are there other states that are ahead of us in this type of a program?
Commissioner Peterson, please.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Anderson, I'm not familiar. The federal government does have value-added grant that we used to piggyback on when we had this grant, and we kind of used them in concert together, where that one, Mr. Huguenin might be able to explain it a little better, but, you know, I think that's where we look at it. Mr. Huguenin, I think he also said, too, where this gives us an opportunity to perhaps leverage some of those federal dollars and, again, give our co-ops and our farmers a leg up. But Paul, I don't know if you have other thoughts about that.
Mr. Huguenin?
Mr. Chair, members, nothing specific other than that when that program existed, we were able to work closely with USDA and partner with them to leverage federal money. I'm not familiar with other states who have specific programs targeting co-ops. I just know that, you know, historically in Minnesota, we have a pretty proud tradition of cooperatives and still have very successful farmer-owned cooperatives. And this was a way to help build on that spirit. Whereas in some parts of the country, those just aren't that common of an organizational tool. But in the Midwest, having farmers own their own investments in value added and has been accepted and successful.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Aaron, Senator Murphy's had her hand up for quite a while. Senator Murphy, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Just a couple of questions because we didn't hear this in the Senate. So I think first for Representative Vang, you mentioned in your testimony your experience with the issue of hemp. And I'm just wondering if you could describe a little bit more about how your experience and this proposal fit together, and maybe draw a little bit more of a picture for me about what you would hope that would be accomplished if we were successful with this language.
Representative Vang, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Senator Murphy. So I can give a little bit of background regarding the hemp industry. You know, in 2018, Minnesota legalized growing hemp. Before then, it was a research pilot program. And now, since 2018, farmers are able to grow hemp legally. However, with this hemp industry is starting to it's a robust industry right now, where there's farmers are having issues of finding processors to process their hemp, as well as finding buyers for their hemp. And so they're starting to, you know, farmers have found a way to form cooperatives to kind of help build their capital and fund, you know, processing facilities and such. And so that's one alternative model that farmers can come together to further build out a robust hemp industry here in Minnesota.
Senator Murphy, anything further?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Vang, for that. And over my years, of course, I've heard a lot of examples about, you know, farmers and their ability or lack thereof sometimes to get what they grow to market. I have a question for the commissioner and then one for Mr. Huguenin. Commissioner Peterson, you mentioned a Kernza cooperative, and I'm just wondering if you could share a little bit more about that experience or what you know about that, please.
Commissioner Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Senator Murphy. Maybe Mr. Huguenin, I know he's worked with them too, but it was a group of farmers that are putting together, a small group of farmers, and they really were looking for assistance in helping develop the co-op and help get some of the different things done business-wise, but also structure and different pieces going forward with their co-op. And it was exciting to see, you know, and that we can help support that or develop it. But I think maybe Paul might know a little bit more about it. I'm not sure. So,
Mr. Huguenin, please.
That particular one, I don't think I know more than the commissioner does on that. Just that, you know, as farmers come together with ideas and they want to pursue opportunities for a farmer-owned co-op, one of the things the bill does is it allows them it allows us to make grants to help them with the organizational part of it, because that can be a little bit tricky. That can be, I mean, there's legal hoops that you need to jump through as you organize any business, whether it's a farmer-owned co-op or a LLC or you name it. This would allow farmers to access resources to help them get organized in a way that makes sense for them moving forward.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, just one more question, if that's all right.
Please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Mr. Huguenin. Then you are testifying to the question I had. So if a cooperative or a group comes and applies for this funding, if we put this in place, would there be advice that would come along with that application from the department to make sure that those hoops that you're describing, the sort of the roadblocks that might get in the way of the successful formation, and then success at the effort. Is there advice that would come from the department or others who have that kind of experience to help fledgling co-op?
Mr. Huguenin.
Mr. Chair, Senator Murphy. We would not be, you know, giving advice to people. We're not the organizational experts on how to go about that. The potential grant funding would allow them to go to places for whom this is their area of expertise. For example, just one example is there's a regional organization called Cooperative Development Services that works to help cooperatives of all kinds develop, whether they're farmer-owned cooperatives or senior housing co-ops, you name it. But there are organizations who can help people with legal documents and organizational strategies. There are other consultants as well who do that. But I would not be offering advice to people on how they should best organize. But that's part of what this program does, is allow farmers access to resources so that they can make smart decisions and set up their organization in a way that makes sense for the long haul.
Thank you, Mr. Huguenin, and thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Senator Murphy. Representative Lippert, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would just add a little bit about the Kernza Co-op. I mean, conversation with those farmers, and they are looking for support for feasibility study and marketing analysis right now. The Kernza conversation, as far as marketing is gone to this point, has been related to large companies, PepsiCo, General Mills. They think there's a real opportunity in that mid-level to market Kernza, and so really want to explore that. But this kind of grant and support will be very helpful for them.
Thank you. Senator Westrum again, please.
Mr. Chair, just a couple of questions. Paul, I guess maybe, or Commissioner. So my understanding on the value added grant money or the new market development, you probably could do this with. You can just incorporate that in your answer, but talk a little bit more about the federal fund, like the likeliness that maybe there would be this flexibility, and how would it connect to COVID somehow? Do you think we can make that connection? And if so, I'm kind of trying to figure out how we could, but you can just expand on that, or the likelihood of federal funds being able to potentially be tapped or accessed on this would be helpful. And then one more follow-up.
Commissioner Peterson or Mr. Huguenin?
I'll start, and then Paul can add in. You know, I think there's a lot of different ways. I think by having this language to it, it helps us really work to assess the situation as we, you know, work on developing co-ops, because we can also work with what the programs that, you know, currently may exist within the federal government, again, to kind of enhance or really assess that so that we can really help some of these co-ops get started. But then also having the language, you know, we look for opportunities, whether it's through CARES or ARP or federal dollars that may come available. We can be unique and say, oh, we have this language. This is what we'd like to do with it. And this is unique to Minnesota. And so that's where we as the grants, you know, our department and the Paul's grant team, they look constantly for options to bring dollars into the state. And that is one good thing too, I'd say, about, because we have Agri, you know, we can be aggressive when we can look at a lot of these different things or opportunities to bring those federal dollars in. So, and we would work with USDA, and this is housed in the rural development section of the USDA. You know, I think there's a lot of good things that we could do with it. There's no specific dollars that I know of at this time. However, there may be opportunities, you know, that we can, you know, continue to look through, whether it's through ARP as that goes forward or different pieces or other dollars that may be coming available. Paul, I don't know, may have some stuff to add.
Mr. Huguenin?
No, actually, Commissioner, I think you touched on everything there. So thank you.
Thank you. Any further discussion on that? Senator Western.
Mr. Chair, Paul, the would it be specifically to cooperatives, or could farmers joined together in an LLC or an LLP? Would it have to be just cooperatives, do you think? And to that end, I think one of the unique aspects of cooperatives is sometimes they have a delivery requirement or a growth, a growing requirement that if you're a member, you also have to grow, you know, X number of acres or X number of bushels or X number of, you name the product. But would it be only cooperatives, or would that not matter on what structure they set up?
Mr. Huguenin.
Mr. Chair, Senator Westrom, that's a really good question. So this language is to help farmers specifically form cooperatives. However, one of the things I would say is part of that process is they are looking at, you know, ideal organizational structures. So potentially they may originally form as a completely 100% farmer-owned cooperative. At some point, they may make the decision, hey, we would be better off as an LLC or to bring in additional outside investment from non-producers. But the intent of this is to help farmers form organizations where they control all of the equity. But if they do the homework right on the front end, and that's what this is designed to do, sometimes there may be a different ownership structure that makes more sense. And certainly if they decide to pursue that, they can. But this funding is designed for those folks on the front end to form farmer-owned cooperatives. So it is limited to that.
Okay. Mr. Chair, one follow-up question.
Senator Westman, please.
Paul, and I guess Commissioner maybe, this was not an initiative or an effort put forward by your department, our look here, there wasn't a Senate companion either. But is that correct?
Commissioner Peterson.
Mr. Chairman and Mr. Chairman, correct.
Okay.
That is, yep.
Okay. Well, that was a great discussion on the cooperatives. I'll just add one thing. You know, that's the cooperative model has been used for quite some time in Minnesota, not only on the large scale that we see out in the sugar production, but I've got the minutes of the last meetings and the treasury of the Beaver Township Threshing Cooperative established about 100 years ago. And that allowed a lot of these small emerging immigrant farmers up in Beaver Township in Coochin County to succeed in agriculture. So I've always been a fan of cooperatives, big or small. So thanks for your discussion on this, and hopefully we can work something out here. Next up, we're going to talk about the farmer lender mediation extension. You can refer to pages 49 to 52.
Mr. Chair, this is Nancy.
Nancy Connolly, please.
Representative Hansen is available now, so if you can do the treated seed.
Okay, we're going to skip to the treated seed labeling disposal. We have Representative Chair Hansen available to chime in. Please refer to page 20 and 29 of your booklet. Representative Hansen, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And, you know, I thought I would actually come over and make sure I got Senator Westrom to come back to the Environment Committee, but I'm not sure if we can do, we both have to be in multiple places at the same time. So Senator Westrom, if you figured out how to do that easier, let me know. The treated seed provisions, members, you know, we've been dealing with pollinator issues for many years, and the issue of treated seed with neonicotinoids, we've had testimony, you know, over the years that almost all of the corn that is planted in Minnesota and throughout the country is treated with seed. And the world of seed has changed a lot from when we were young, Chair Sundin and Chair Westrom. You know, back then you had My dad, a couple neighbors, would buy seed. He'd buy seed from everybody who was selling different types of seed to make sure he kept everybody happy, because they were all neighbors and lived in the area and went to school and went to church with each other. But there's been a lot of consolidation and changes in seed treatment. And with those changes, there is a gap in the regulatory umbrella of how we dispose of treated seed. So what's in the provisions that are in the bill, one is a educational component to make sure that farmers who are planting treated seed know the impacts on the environment and to pollinators. So it is not a regulatory label, it is a notification, similar, I would say, to the label that was put on cigarette packages, saying this product, if you remember back on the cigarette packages, the warning label from the Surgeon General that said this may be hazardous to your health. And that educational effort was done to provide information in case people were not aware of the impacts that that product may have. Treated seed is not a pesticide. The pesticide application, the regulatory nexus for the Department of Agriculture occurs when the pesticide is applied to the seed. The planting of the seed is not a pesticide application. The seed treatment or the seed sale, when that goes out, the Department of Ag also has regulatory authority over that sale of seed. But what happens with leftover seed? So there may be leftover seed at the farmer level, there may be leftover seed at the dealer level, and there may be leftover seed at the manufacturer level. Now, there's been a great deal of concentration in seed producers, but we did have testimony in the House from a seed producer about the difficulty of properly disposing unused treated seed. Back when we were young, Chair Sundin, you had bin run seed. You had farmers hold their seed year after year and they would plant it. That's not the case. Actually, that's prohibited now. So you have seed that is designed, genetically designed to match some of the chemistry that may be applied for it. The germination rate in the second year is less. So seed, there is unused seed. What is done with that unused seed? The testimony that we had in committee was that that would come back and that we had a Minnesota seed producer who was shipping it to Mead, Nebraska. And in Nebraska, our colleagues found that there was unused treated seed coming from all over the Midwest. So what we've done in the bill here is prohibit that use of unused treated seed for ethanol production. And we also took the University of Minnesota's recommendations on disposal methods that should be prohibited. Guidance that has been there for many years, and we put that into statute. For example, not burying it near water, not burning it in the corn stove in the shed, those type of things for not only environmental protection, but for protection for people, the applicators and the farmers. I know there's been testimony about how does this affect actual, you know, the farmer impact. I think it's very difficult for anybody to say this is what is happening, that nothing wrong is happening in Minnesota, just as like it's impossible to say there's nothing good happening in Minnesota. These protections, I believe, are minimal things that we can do as a state. One, providing guidance with a notification on the seed bag. Two, prohibiting disposal methods that may hurt the environment and people. And three, prohibiting that unused treated seed would go into ethanol production. That is the bill. One final thing, I talked to my renter this morning because I was watching him plant my field last week. And within one day I saw corn planted by horse with a two-row planter. I saw an old four-row planter like my dad used to use. I saw an eight-row planter, and my renter was using a 24-row planter. There are 230,000 seeds of corn in a 50-pound bag. 50-pound bag is what I used to lug and put in that four-row or eight-row planter when I was younger and empty that into the container. Now you have many people, you have people using a 50 pound bag, but you also have boxes, pro boxes, I think they're called, where large volumes. So you may have a farmer that is going directly to the manufacturer, or they may still be using the dealer for those 50 pound bags or boxes. So there's a diversity of planting planters, and there are a diversity of methods for getting the seed out and into the ground. Our purpose is what happens when you don't put it in the ground and how to make sure it's properly disposed of. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Chair Hansen. I know your time is limited. Any questions to Chair Hansen? Okay. Evidently not. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Okay. Any discussion on the treated seed labeling or disposal issues? Nothing at this time. Okay. Hopefully that was helpful information provided. Back to the farmer lender mediation extension. Please refer to page 49 through 52 of your resources here. And we'll hear from Representative Looper.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So as we heard yesterday, there are two key pieces of the farmer lender mediation language. The first is a reauthorization of the program. It's been extremely helpful for farmers, so they can find a negotiated solution that can keep them farming. And this is good for farmers, rural communities, and rural economies too. We need more farmers, not fewer. We need to help farmers stay on the land and keep farming. And as we had conversation about extending the mediation timeframe due to COVID-19, Marinelle Priestler, the director of the program, who will say a few words after I'm finished, shared in the Agriculture Committee that the normal 90-day timeframe often isn't enough time. That the time frame is often rushed. And as I've had conversations with more farm advocates and farmers too, they've talked about how the lending landscape has changed. They're increasingly dealing with national lending institutions that aren't connected to the community, don't have those community relationships. These large national lending institutions can be difficult to navigate in a timely fashion, and that can make it difficult to get things done. The clock is ticking when mediation starts. So this language extends the time frame for mediation from 90 days to 120 days as well. But I'll turn things over to Ms. Priestler to say more about the makeup of the program and what she sees from her perspective.
Marinelle Priestler, please.
Marinelle Priestler, Director of the Farmer Lender Mediation Program. Chair Sundin and members of the committee. The farmer lender mediation is part of USDA's certified state agricultural mediation program that gives farmers and their creditors the opportunity to renegotiate, restructure, or resolve the farm debt. It's under a national program from USDA. The Coalition of Accredited Mediation Programs, it has been reauthorized as part of the recent federal farm bill. A creditor with the intent of enforcing collection on agricultural debt of more than $15,000 secured by agricultural property or 60 acres must offer the option of mediation before proceeding with foreclosure, repossession, cancellation of a contract, or collection of a judgment. That is when the University of Minnesota Extension gets involved with a team of mediators and financial analysts. If the farmer chooses to take advantage of mediation, the first step is an orientation meeting. The farmer, creditor, financial analyst, and mediator meet to explain the process and to determine if financial information needs to be prepared. Successful mediation requires two things: neutrality on the part of the mediator and compromise on the part of both the debtor and the creditor. The current situation is not working for either the debtor or the creditor. Farmers must change their operation to make it profitable. This means increase income, restructure debt, take long-term and or take four short-term debt and put it to long-term, or liquidate assets. Creditors may need to restructure debt and security or reschedule loan payments. The mediator leads and manages discussion as a neutral party without making decisions or judgments. The mediator does not take sides or decide how this dispute should be resolved. If the mediation does not resolve in an agreement after 90 days, the parties are free to pursue whatever course of action is available, often with a clear understanding of the facts, the issues, and the positions of the parties. The University of Minnesota Extension manages the process as part of a commitment to agriculture and rural communities. The program has proven to be an economic asset. I've enclosed your information for you, the executive summary for last year. We go October 1st is our fiscal year. The existing timeline of the state statute is 90 days to conduct mediation. However, with the notifications required to this under the state statute, we really end up with 60 days for mediation sessions. We often find that is not enough time to execute a final agreement. Extending the timeline of mediation would give farmers and lenders more time to reach a mutually beneficial plan for managing debt. We are finding that in this time of uncertainty with the COVID, the financial pain and intensity felt by farmers may not be reflected in the number of default notices. 2020 has seen substantial market interruptions due to COVID-19 pandemic. The outbreak brings more uncertainty regarding prices, government programs, and a broader economy. The ag stimulus payments, which are only going to be in this last year, it's not going to be something in a budget for every year, has rescued many farms. Many producers are selling assets, liquidating the business, tightening family living, and depending more on non-farm income with health insurance benefits. We hear tragic stories daily from farmers, financial analysts, advocates, and mediators. The stress level in agriculture is high. Many producers never thought that they would be in a financial crisis. There are more divorces, orders for protection, family division and strife, and health situations. It is difficult working with the complex financial issues and help individuals make life-changing decisions with the amount of stress that they are experiencing. This extension of timeline is warranted given the unprecedented challenges farmers and lenders are facing. We are often waiting for farmers, lenders, and other participants to recover from COVID-19. I recently had a situation where the cattle truck had COVID-19, the driver, so the producer could not ship his cattle. Another case where the buyer of the real estate had COVID-19 and was quarantined. We had an attorney out for a while. Several loan officers have been restricted and they cannot, they're in quarantine. We had a producer that had a heart attack just last week. All of this is happening more often than we would expect. Most of this is beyond human control. There are many important actions that may need to be completed between the sessions. And it does take longer between these sessions to get things done. We need exchange and completion of financial information, long-term financial planning. Courthouses are open on a limited basis. Land appraisals, obtain purchase agreements, conduct land surveys, abstract updates, loan applications from another lender. Working with USDA, they have consolidated many offices and they are short-staffed. They're consulting with legal counsel sometimes, preventing a bankruptcy with a workout. Workout with the Main Street debt, listing the land for sale, contacting machinery auction companies, selling and shipping livestock, consulting and planning for tax ramifications of liquidation. Currently, we're using conference calls and once in a while Zoom to hold meetings. It is difficult to have a face-to-face meeting because we can't even find a location because of the restrictions. This extension of timeline will hopefully allow time to resume face-to-face mediations, and at some point in the future, we can say that yes, we can meet face-to-face. As I said, successful mediation requires two things: neutrality on the part of the mediator and compromise on the part of the debtor and the creditor. Are there questions?
Senator Anderson, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Preisler, sorry if I got that wrong, but I wanted to know how many farmers are going out of business each and every day or each and every month of the year.
Director? Director Preisler?
Mr. Chair and Senator, did I just, no, Senator Anderson, I thought maybe I just demoted you or I am. All right. I don't know that figure, but the Department of Agriculture may know that.
Is Tom Peterson on?
Commissioner Peterson, do you have an answer?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Anderson, you know, no, we don't keep track of, you know, what I will say is, you know, we can look at the numbers. So we look at the USDA numbers. And last year from 2019 to 2020, we went from 68,000 farmers to 67,500 farmers. So roughly we lost 500 people that qualify for the USDA definition of a farm, which is $1,000 worth of gross income per year, which isn't a lot, but that is a lot of farmers who went out of business. We know we lost over 100 dairy farmers last year, for example, went out of dairying, but they might not have gone out of farming. They may have gone switched to beef farming or something like that. So we do know we lose farmers. We do know we have hundreds of farmers in mediation. We do know that Minnesota is now the top five in bankruptcies, you know, in the nation. I can tell you that personally, I've talked to two farmers this morning who are going through bankruptcy right now, or near, or being, one farmer is being foreclosed on today. And so, you know, it is a serious situation. It's hard right now because we look at the markets, we say, oh, farmers are in great shape, this is awesome. But, you know, keep in mind before this year, we've had six or seven down years of prices. So I wish I had numbers, but that's the best numbers I can do, is about 500 farmers last year went out of business. But that could be for a very varying reasons.
Thank you.
Senator Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I know that I have a farmer right now that has gone through mediation, is in the process of mediation, and he is being told by the creditor that he needs to sell part of his farm to pay up his debt. And yet he was given an opportunity of 6 years to pay. But when it came time for selling his product, the product was basically not accepted by the creditor because I don't know all the reasons behind it. But it seems like the rules and regulations that have come in because these new lending organizations have come together and formed new lending organizations under new names. And they're not even from the state of Minnesota. They're not even, I mean, he's already been confirmed that if he would go to the local banking association, they would accept his request for lending of getting his beans and corn in the field. But these new operations coming in are basically not very unwieldy. They don't even want to work with the farmers anymore. And it seems so sad to hear that he wants to leave his farm to his sons. He has two sons that want to come and farm with him. But, you know, these young people, they need to learn, and they learn from dad and they learn from grandpa. And they need to know, learn the financial costs and all the other things that go along with it. So I'm very concerned that we start losing these farmers. Well, and people with experience are being drummed out of the business just because prices have gone so low, whether it's milk prices or bean prices, whatever the product may be. it seems so sad to see that they don't want to work with these members. And so I'm just concerned that we continue to lose farmers and we don't have anybody that has the experience to teach these young people, especially their sons or their daughters and their son-in-laws who want to go farming. They're basically drummed out because of the financial cost of it. So I'm looking forward to what we do with this legislation.
Thank you, Senator. Senator Westrum.
Mr. Chair, Ms. Preissler, and the current process is 90 days. As I've looked into it a little bit more, can you explain, it's kind of broke into two chunks, the first 30 days for notices, and then 60 days in mediation. And maybe staff can then help us follow up after that. My understanding is it's kind of broke down fairly clearly 30 days for notices and 60 days for mediation. But is there anything that prohibits mediation from starting sooner than 30 days into the process? And what are the notices that would take so long to get? Or can you start mediation at day 10 instead of waiting 30 days? And then council maybe can help shed a little more light on it for me and the rest of the conferees.
Director Preissler, please.
Chairman Sundin and Senator Westrum, the 30 days in between that, in order to follow the state statute, once we received a request for mediation, we have a certain amount of days before we need to have it lined up with a mediator, a financial analyst, and to have an orientation and a first session. In the meantime, they have a right, the initial creditor and the debtor have a right, and they have a 3-day time. So 3 days for mailing, 3 days time once they receive it, 3 days back, there's your 9 days just for choosing a mediator, according to state statute.
Okay.
Once we choose the mediator, then we send out a creditor claim form to all the creditors. They have to respond before the initial session, which would be 30 days out from the date that they request mediation. So we are waiting for lining up the sessions. And then if there's attorneys involved, we have court dates that they have already set. And so sometimes that we have to work around those court dates. We have to work around the creditor's dates, the debtor's dates. And then we have to wait for a choosing of a mediator. So that's 10 days. But and we haven't sent out to all the creditors yet. So we're sending out everything in a timely manner from the office. And the least we could get it down is probably 20 days. Excuse me. And that's not giving really enough time to do it. We could shave a little bit off, but we're not going to shave off very much. If we have an impending something like right now, when people have not got their operating and they need to get in the field, we try to do it as soon as it comes in, and we try to, but we have to make sure that we allow them to choose the mediator. So following state statute is what takes the 30 days. Before the initial session, we have the orientation within the 30 days, but not the initial session.
I see.
Senator Westrum?
Okay. And I guess that's helpful. One of the other points I think we had in our committee discussion, 2 points, I guess, Director Preissler. I recall the discussion about how many of these mediations end up coming to a resolution, and I remember 89% is I think what you had indicated to us. Is that
that seems like a pretty solid high number. Is that what you're still seeing, a fairly successful outcome to the mediation program? And then are the parties able, if they're close to needing to sell the cattle and somebody comes down with COVID or a health condition, are they able to extend the mediation beyond the 90 days? My understanding is they can if there's been good progress made, but what's your understanding of that?
Chair Sundin and Senator Westrom, yes, they may, by mutual consent, they may extend the timeline of mediation, and we're finding that that happens because there isn't enough time to get things done. And it's not that people are just sitting in between the two in between sessions. There is homework from every mediation for people to get done. And so when they are going into or having the next session in 3 weeks, the mediators will review. We would like this, this, and this completed by then. Now, that's where we run into problems with outside people. And as I said, we have so many directions that things can take. So maybe we're waiting for a land appraiser, or we're waiting for a farmer's home or from farm service agency. They move it very, very slowly nowadays because they are so understaffed. They have combined many offices again, and trying to get a new beginning farmer started is very, very difficult because we don't have enough time.
And Ms. Preisler, what do you mean by getting a new farmer started? How would that relate to a mediation with an existing farmer situation?
Director Preisler.
Chair Sundin and Senator Westrom, that was just like what you were talking about. I believe it was Senator Anderson about the farmer trying to get his sons in the operation. I may even know who he's talking about because I think I am the mediator. And if we're waiting for Farm Service Agency to work a beginning farmer with that case, if we can get that done, and we're not going to be able to do it in 90 days, we're already past the 90 days. So far, the financer, which is very, very huge company, not located in Minnesota. They had to be in England, educated about, I had enlightened them about the mediation program in Minnesota, because they were going to start foreclosure without even going through it. That is a very typical one where he's trying to get his son start and family started in it. And they're going through beginning farmer and they qualify. They've had there's a timeline that FSA is supposed to have all their work done and give you an answer back. We find if they have not gotten everything done, the answer is no, because they didn't look at it good enough. And so then we have to start over again and make sure that everything is put right before them. So we just need more time. And that's what I need about a new farmer coming in, is another generation. We don't have what we had in the 80s where people were coming in who were investors. We don't have land investors very often anymore. What we have are people trying to take over an independent operation. And yes, this is a very large operation. Very, very large. We're talking about, how do I say this very carefully? We're just talking a huge operation that's going to affect Main Street horribly if we don't come up with a plan. And we're so close to a plan, I can taste it.
Well, Ms. Preisler, in that case, have they extended the mediation period mutually, or are they just, how are they doing that? If if you can expand on that a little bit more.
Director Preissner.
Chairman Sundin and Senator Westrom, I have used every technique I know how to get them to extend mediation. It's in everyone's best interest to work this out instead of having a bankruptcy. And that's where it's headed if we can't get it worked out in mediation. And if this goes into bankruptcy, Main Street is going to get hurt terribly.
Okay, Senator Westrom, any further?
I think that's good for now, Mr. Chair.
Okay, thank you. Representative Lippert, anything to top off the conversation?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just, going back to Senator Anderson's comments, you know, this is what I've been hearing from farmers regularly too. And I think the more distant the lending institution is, the less stake they have in extending mediation. And so that's just an increasing concern for the health of rural communities, for the future of these farmers. And, it points to just giving a little bit more time.
Okay.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, I did have a follow-up.
Representative, or Senator Westrom, please.
Ms. Preissner, you made a comment and I meant to ask it, but I forgot that you said we are not dealing with land investors like we were in the 80s anymore. Can you expand on that? I'm not sure I understood what you meant, but I'm trying to understand the distinguished difference. Or was there situations where you had other investors or neighbors or maybe somebody that had financial resources that might come in and invest and want to buy the land and but not farm it, so they might rent it back to that person? Or what did you, what can you expand on what you meant by that comment?
Okay.
Chairman Sundin and Senator Westrom, yes. In the 1980s, we had the stock market wasn't making that much money, but land was. And so we had people from outside of Minnesota, outside of the area, come in and buy land because it was cheaper then, and then they would rent it out. Now, very seldom did they come in and buy land and then farm it themselves. The idea was that they would have an income in the future and they would be landowners, but not those kind of landowners that don't live here and they don't support the community because they are only interested in land rent. And that's what we had in the 80s. People buy as an opportunity to have solid investment in land. Now, in this time and age, we have people who would like to expand their operations, and they are farmers, and many of them, like they, Commissioner Peterson said, many of our milk producers are now cow-calf, or they're feeding steers, or they've turned into feedlots because they've got the facilities that they can make use of. And when the milk prices were so bad that they were paying everybody else and not themselves, so now we have a different type of farming again. And people are trying to convert from dairy to maybe cattle. And because the cattle prices were so bad for so long, we have huge feedlots that are in trouble. And we need to, because most of those, they will be shopping locally. They get their feed locally. They make use of labor from the area. And that hurts the community when they go down. They're going to take people with them.
Senator Westrom, anything further?
Not at this time, Mr. Chair. Thanks.
Okay, thank you. Westrom. Thank you so much. I guess we're off to the next topic. It would be the Board of Animal Health changes. We've been entertaining, discussing on the House side more so than in the Senate. And I'll just talk about that for a few minutes, then entertain some questions. I hope we can come to a resolution on this.
Page, Mr. Chair?
Oh, excuse me. It'd be page 33.
Thank you.
Yep. And so we've got, I think the department's got, may have some comments on the one change, but this came to me from a concerned person, a band member, a chair of the Fond du Lac tribe, actually, and they would seek recognition and seeking some recognition on this topic because they're entertaining the thought of introducing elk into the their property, the tribal property, and throughout the state. Now, my understanding is that ceded land takes up 20-some percent of the state's real estate. Mostly in northeast Minnesota, that Arrowhead region, it's all ceded land. And they do have the ability and the right to introduce elk and other wildlife species if they were to do so. But they want, my understanding is they want to do it right. And they want to cooperate with the state of Minnesota and be heard on the Board of Animal Health for most particularly that reason. So that triggered the bill to be introduced and passed through committee to add a federally recognized tribal member onto the with knowledge of animal health to the board. And then the other one is the small animal vet as well. So I'm hoping that maybe the department could talk about the small animal provision. Is Commissioner Peterson available still?
Maybe. Mr. Chairman, and this really is in the Board of Animal Health statute and purview. So I don't know if they're on or not and want to comment on that.
I'm just asking if you had any concerns about this.
Mr. Chairman, we are open to this discussion on this piece of adding two members. We've been meeting with the ag groups and with the administration, and you know, I can work on getting a final okay or piece on this as we go forward, but it is something the administration is open to looking at. I think the concern is if we add members to the board that they're qualified, which I think is laid out here in the language. The other piece on it, I think that we've had discussions on, is that if we add one small vet, that the other two vets that are currently on the board, that we would specify then that they would be large animal veterinarians. That's not in the language, but I would just say in my own comments, that would be something I think would be important. So I urge you, as you look forward to this from a agriculture side, not a perspective of the Board of Animal Health, that we maintain the integrity. You know, the last year has really shown the importance of partnership we have with the department, I mean with the board, but having that knowledge on the board is important. So we're open to that and having that discussion, but want to have qualified people, and then also consider if we're going to designate one for small animals, which I think is important, that we designate the other two to be large animal veterinarians, because it's important that that's mostly what they deal with. So that's my comments. Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner. Senator Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess that kind of the commissioner took the words out of my mouth. I think that acknowledging that the other two would have large animal experience, I think the knowledge of animal health is a broad statement. It's a large umbrella, and I think we need to be more specific when we look at the animal health area. And I agree with the commissioner. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Senator Anderson. And I hear what you're saying there. We certainly don't want any real novices on that board. And I think maybe we can reach out and maybe clean up that language to, you know, specify someone with wildlife experience and involved in the wildlife protection services or whatever. You know, I'm looking towards somebody with possibly a game warden or somebody involved in research on their survey release program. So we're learning, and I'm looking forward to cleaning up that language and something that will be acceptable. So thank you for your comments. Anything further on the Board of Animal Health? Okay, thank you. We have treated seed again. I think we covered that. I don't know where we're going to go with that. Rick Hansen is not available. He's somewhat of our expert on that, but we can reach out to Senator Murphy. She had Senate File 794. Senator Murphy, would you care to comment on 794?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I was grateful to hear the testimony yesterday, and I think it's important that we understand what, not only what has what has transpired in another state and the conflict that that's created, but also we should be thinking about how we are getting ahead of this issue in Minnesota. In the testimony we heard yesterday, there's some expression that we don't have a problem here, but the question I have that I suppose would be a question for Representative Hansen is about the you know, what is the right way to deal with the seed? And is there a means for proper disposal if the ways in which is being described in this proposal before us, we're saying how not to do it. And it makes me think about how do we do it? And I think it's something that this conference committee should explore. And we, you know, from my perspective, it is getting ahead of a problem in a way that is useful for Minnesota. And so I was grateful for the testimony this morning and yesterday, and I want to continue to work with both the House and Senate members on this issue.
Mr. Chair, could you give us a page reference?
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm going to fall asleep at the wheel here. This would be 28 and 29.
Thank you.
Any further comments on the treated seed, the labeling disposal issue? Okay, I think we're schooled by Representative Hansen quite well. This might be a sticky issue, but we've got great minds behind it. Senator Westrom, any comments on this? Senator Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Murphy, a question for her, Mr. Chair. Is the disposal of the seeds, besides having a concern for that, is there something else that you would like to see maybe in the language, or something else that you're concerned about that should be taken out of the language?
Senator Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you, Senator Anderson. And my question is rooted in the testimony we heard both yesterday and then this morning. And so I don't have, my questions are not rooted in what I see in the language in the House, but it is something I want to explore a little bit more with, for instance, the corn growers. I'm going to meet with them a little later today. And something that I'm happy to dig into a little further and come back to the committee with if that's acceptable to you. But no, I don't have an immediate proposal in terms of the language change. I just believe that what we heard yesterday and again today makes me curious about that one question, and also clear that this is an important issue for us to tackle in this committee.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Anderson, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm wondering if the department has a concern about this, or are there other states that are dealing with this same matter, and how have they, if anybody has an answer to how other states are dealing with treated seed and the disposal of it. Maybe there's some other references or some other comments that can be made by the department.
Commissioner Peterson and company.
Mr. Chair.
Okay, Whitney, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Senator Anderson. Since the issue occurred in Nebraska with one specific ethanol plant, a lot of the departments around the country have been talking about this issue, and there are similar bills to the House language in several different states. And I know Nebraska actually did pass a bill banning the use of treated seeds in final products in things like ethanol.
And Mr. Chair?
Senator Anderson.
Ms. Whitney Place, what did the language say in, say, Nebraska versus what we have today? And should, as Senator Murphy said, should there be other expanded language to meet the certain situation that we're dealing with, as how to deal with these neonicotinoids placed in seed for planting as far as disposal?
Commissioner Place.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Senator Anderson, so currently we don't have any language that defines where treated seed can be used. And in fact, at the department, we don't really have any authority over treated seed because it's exempt from FIFRA. But so our language would be similar. The language in the House bill, as it pertains to utilization of treated seed in a final processed product, would be similar to what was passed in Nebraska. The House language also includes the labeling language that Representative Hansen just spoke about that would be required to be on seed bags. And then in the environment omnibus bill, that's where we would define kind of the waste stream for treated seed specifically. And I think there's rulemaking authority for PCA in that bill.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Anderson.
Ms. Place, is there anything coming down from the feds on this, from the federal government in the agriculture area?
Director Place.
Mr. Chair and Senator Anderson, at this time, we have not heard anything from our counterparts at EPA on whether they will specifically be regulating this, but it is a topic that's been discussed through NASDA, our national organization, and amongst the state departments of agriculture.
Thank you.
Senator Anderson. Anything further?
That'll do it.
Okay, thank you. Any other discussion on this issue? Treated seeds. Okay, thank you, Commissioner Place. Next up, we have the food retailer fee dedicated account. You can reference page 30 of your resources there. And we'll hear from Catherine Simon, the Food and Feed Safety Division Director. Catherine Simon, please.
Good morning, Chair. Can you hear me?
Yes.
All right. Catherine Simon again, the Minnesota Department of Agriculture and the Food and Feed Safety Division. I am the director of the division. This particular section is about creating a dedicated agricultural fund for our food handler licensing fees. And included in that would be the inspection fees related to our vending machine inspections. So currently those fees are not dedicated to program use. They are not the full amount of funds that support our program, but we are looking to get a dedicated account to give us some additional long-term planning mechanisms with that. So there is the assumption that we would have a reduction in the appropriation back to our program, correlating to the estimated amount of what those fees would be. And I'm available for any questions.
Okay, thank you. Any questions on the vending machines? Senator Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Simon, when you say vending machine inspection, I'm a little, I guess,
Can you expand on that vending machine? Give me some further clarification.
Yes. So,
Director Simon,
thank you. So yes, our food licensing covers our packaged food. So Minnesota Department of Agriculture does grocery stores and other retail food operators, in addition to food manufacturers and food warehouses. So part of the retail food sales does include the businesses that own and run vending machines. It is the fee collection for those machines individually, happened to be a separate section of that statute. So it's just a clarification that this proposal would address both of those fees, both the food handler license fee itself, as well as the fees that are collected from the retail operators that do vending machine inspections.
So Ms. Simon, thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Simon, so what specifically in a vending machine, what are you looking for as far as an inspection? I mean, what kind of foods are in there that would be concerning to the Department of Agriculture?
Director Simon?
Yes, Representative. Thank you. The vending machine inspections for packaged foods that are just at ambient are considered a low-risk inspection. The types of things that we would look for would be very, very similar to other brick-and-mortar facilities that we look at. So insect evidence, rodent evidence, making sure that the foods in there are from commercial facilities, so they're labeled properly and have all the information necessary. It is an infrequent inspection, and we typically conduct them in blocks. So when we inspect per licensee. So we would look at the food handler, who typically has multiple machines, and we would go through, and then we figure out where they have their machines located. And then do low-risk spot checks on those facilities.
Okay. Senator Anderson?
At this time, I have no more questions. Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Western, please.
Mr. Chair, question. What's the push for setting these funds up as opposed to we've just statutorily approve it every year and review the account. Once they go offline, they kind of go on autopilot. What's the push for that here? If you could expand on that a little bit more.
Director Simon.
Yes, Representative and Senator. The reason why we're looking to get these in dedicated funds is because it would allow us a little bit more connection with changes and fluxes within our food industries. As you know, with those appropriations, most of that information, most of those funds go back towards staffing, and sometimes it can create some restrictions on how timely we can respond to changes in the industry. So making sure we have the ability to do better salary projections and to be able to add staff when needed so that we can respond to increases in the industry size. And so this would give us a little bit more of a real-time response when we have new licensees and increases in the inventories.
Okay. Thank you,
Mr. Chair.
Senator Westrom?
My understanding is you're also asking for a fee increase. Can you expand on that?
Director Simon, please.
Yes, there is no increase in the fees right now. So at this point, it's merely in getting the account dedicated, it's actually a reduction in what would be appropriated. So there would be no change in the license fees or in those vending machine inspection fees.
Yeah, thank you.
Mr. Senator Chair, just so to be clear then, there's no fee increase planning in the works or anything you're asking, would be asking. There'd be no fee increase in the foreseeable future.
Director Simon?
At this point, what we're looking at is getting additional information so that we can plan some restructuring in the licensing. So we know right now that the way that our license categories are structured, it makes it very difficult for businesses to identify what license they need, but also to implement their business and have flexibility in how it is that they choose their sales models over time. So what we would choose to do is create a project to be able to get input from our stakeholders and some of our partner agencies on what the licensing structure should look like in the future. And then any fee conversations would be subsequent to that structure being identified. So I will say there's plans for the future, but not specifically related to this bill.
Thank you, Director. Senator Westrom.
Mr. Chair, will there still be general funds used in this fee account as well then in the future, or what can you explain if there would or wouldn't be?
Director Simon.
Yes, so there would be, for our program, there would be a mix now for these food programs, for our manufactured food program and our retail food program. A portion of it would be from these dedicated fee funds, and then there would still be a portion that would be coming from general fund appropriations.
Senator Westrom, anything further?
All right, that's it for now.
Okay. Senator Anderson, please.
Again, thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Simon, is not a vending machine operator considered a food handler also?
Director Simon.
Yes, they are a retail food handler. And so they would apply for a retail food handler license. And then there is an additional inspection fee for each machine that they run.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is there a fee? Right now they're paying fee for, say, they have 20 vending machines. They pay a fee for each of those vending machines and plus a food handler license on top of that.
Director Simon?
Yes, at this time they would have a retail food handler license fee. That's based on their gross annual food sales. And then they would pay that fee for each individual machine that they have.
And so, Mr. Chair.
Senator Anderson, please.
You mentioned, Ms. Simon, in your testimony that you're breaking this out so that you can look at each different area to see if there's a needed for more inspectors to reach out to them. Or was I wrong in your testimony?
Director Simon.
I would say the idea is that this agricultural fund will allow us to be able to have a little more responsiveness to when there are changes. The target is not necessarily the vending machine inspections themselves. They are low risk inspections that are not the bulk of the work that we do. It's more about new businesses that are opening. One of the most significant areas where we work with operators is at the opening of their businesses. And so as we get new inquiries to create businesses, this would allow us with those changes in new operators coming in, it would allow us quicker access to those funds to be able to address staffing shortages at those times if needed.
Senator Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Simon, could you give us an example of new people coming into the industry for food handling or for vending machine opportunities?
Director Simon.
Yes. So most of the changeover that we have actually is in our retail food as well as our manufactured food categories in terms of the body of work that the division covers overall. So pretty much anyone who is going to be selling food in Minnesota is required to have a license. And so a lot of the business that you see changing over, for example, a hardware store, if they're going to be selling food, they would need to have a license. Any new grocery stores, a lot of these new businesses that may start out as cottage food operators who are exempt from licensing, they may transition into small food manufacturers. So those would be some examples. But most of the turnover that we do have is in the smaller business side. So, different boutique shops that are opening up or other small stores that are also selling food.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Anderson.
Could a coffee shop be considered a new licensee?
Director Simon.
Whenever a coffee shop would open, they would require a license. The difference is that they may be licensed by the Department of Health. So the Department of Health will license food service establishments. However, the determination of who will license a single entity is based on the majority of sales that they have. So if majority of what they sell is bakery items or it's going to be those packaged food items that are takeaway, the Department of Agriculture would hold that food license. If it's mostly on-site food service, then the Department of Health would hold it. But they would be new business operators if they're a new entity opening a new establishment.
Senator Anderson.
Well, Mr. Chair, Ms. Simon and anybody else, I'm seeing that the rules and regulations seem to pile up, for businesses to want to have a business. Seems like it's one inspector after the next inspector after another inspector and another fee on top of another fee on top of another fee. And it just seems like businesses are very much put in a quandary as to how long can they exist with more fees involved with trying to make a business work and run in a community. So just doing some observations here as we're listening to the testimony. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator. Senator Westrum, please.
I think my hand is just up yet. I'll take it down. So
your arm must be getting sore. Okay, thanks for that discussion. Thank you, Director Simon. Let's talk about the lab funding. You can refer to pages 25 through 27 of your workbook, if you please. And we have Assistant Commissioner Whitney Place to help us through the discussion on this. Commissioner Place, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, in the governor's budget, the Department of Agriculture requested an increase in pesticide gross sales fees for agricultural products, which would be an increase from 0.55% to 0.90%, and for non-agricultural products from 0.5% to 0.90%. This would generate approximately $2.251 million per year, which would be in addition to the roughly $3.5 million that we collected in fiscal year 2020. I just wanted to also correct something that was said in conference committee yesterday. Disinfectants and sanitizers are already exempt from pesticide gross sales fees, so we won't be making any money off of any sort of product sales that have been increasing due to COVID-19. The largest majority of this fee increase is really to increase the capacity of our world-class laboratory that we have on the Capitol complex. This would help us maintain our laboratory services for environmental testing of water monitoring, pesticide drift sampling, and just altogether making our program work as a whole. A lot of our laboratory equipment is hitting the 10-year life expectancy of that equipment to the point where we can't even get people to fix it anymore. And I also have on the call today our laboratory services director, Gary Horvath, who can speak to some of those laboratory needs as it pertains to the water portion of the lab. So, Mr. Chair, if you want Gary to speak, or we can just take questions as well.
Was the name Horvath?
Horvath, with a V. Hi, for the record, I'm Gary Horvath. I'm the lab director at the Department of Agriculture. Whitney talked about our equipment situation. So for the last number of years, we've been trying to address our capital equipment problem. And that problem is currently we have a $5 million capital equipment. I'm talking about analytical equipment. That's the equipment used to actually run the test. And anything over $30,000. And so of that $5 million inventory, currently $3.3 million is fully depreciated. Now we do continue to operate equipment past its life expectancy, but what we're seeing is we're seeing a greater and greater cost of support. And recently we were informed that two of our large pieces of equipment, mass spectrometers that support supports enforcement, one supports groundwater, are no longer going to be basically serviced by the vendor. That means parts might not be available. And we have all our eggs in these baskets because they're big baskets. They're $500,000 a piece. That's the nature of the chemistry that you need to do this. And so our concern is, if one of these goes down and we can't replace it, we're basically dead in the water and all the efforts in the field could be lost. So We've been looking at strategies, and last session we got some general fund appropriation, which we were very grateful for. But, you know, we took, as an example, it was $285,000 a year for 2 years. We had to set aside the first year, and in the second year, we were able to buy one replacement mass spectrometer that we use for enforcement work. For water work, sorry. And so it's just the level of equipment that needed for the FIFRA work and the groundwater work, pesticide work, of that, basically, so 67%, as I said, is depreciated. With the fee increase that is before you, that basically flips from 67% depreciated to 69%, value. So what I'm really trying to say is the lion's share of our big capital equipment is for pesticide analysis. It's the nature of the beast. We have to have, you know, there's many chemistries out there, and that's reflected in the cost. Some of the costs you see are for the three new compounds. Those all have unique chemistries. So we have to dedicate equipment so that we can operate our normal methodology. It's just very costly work, pesticide residue analysis. We do forensic testing, as Whitney said, for drift and human exposure, accidents, you name it. We test for it, test pesticides in the matrix. Then we have our groundwater fate analysis. So we're very concerned about being able to maintain our service to the program. And a decision was made to include us in the fee increase this year. So that's kind of where we stand. And with that, I gladly take questions.
All right, thank you, Mr. Horvath. Any questions, Mr. Horvath, regarding the equipment the department needs upgrades on? I think Senator Westrum was up first.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, just a clarification, is all of the pesticide fee increase going to go towards laboratory equipment? And if so, what earlier documents show money for urban trainers to be hired? Maybe Ms. Place can talk about that as well, or if that has changed, that'd be helpful to know.
Mr. Horvath.
Mr. Chair, I'll take that one.
Whitney Place.
Mr. Chair, yes, you're correct. Our change item says $1.5056 million would be going to maintain our laboratory services. $350,000 would be going to two laboratory chemists. $325,000 would be going to education and label specialists, and we would like those positions to be focused on urban pesticide use, specifically around pollinator protection. And then $520,000 would be going toward more laboratory activities, specifically as it pertains to one of the recommendations in the OLA audit. That recommended that we increase some of the chemistry that we test for in our monitoring.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Westrum, please. Any further?
That's it, Mr. Chair. Okay.
Thank you. Senator Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm looking at the language, and it says right now that you're going to charge, you want to increase the fee to a 0.9% increase. And then on the second, or the just below the line where we talk about, or the deleted language, just below that, and I think it's relabeled C, an additional fee of 50% of the registration application must be paid by the applicant for each pesticide to be registered. So right now that's already in place, the 50% on top of the 350. And now you want to raise the from 350 up to increase it by 0.9%. And then you take a 50% of that again for each pesticide that's registered. Is that correct, Ms. Place or Mr. Barbath?
Mr. Chair, our pesticide fees work in that we have a registration fee, so that's a one-time cost for each chemical that's registered in the state. And then the fees that we're proposing to increase would be the gross sales fees. So that's a percentage based on the sales of the chemicals. So we're looking to increase those gross sales fees percentages in both the non-ag chemicals and the ag chemicals up to 0.9%. So like I said, you know, right now the ag one is 0.55 and the non-ag one is 0.5. And so we just are moving those both to 0.9.
Senator Anderson. I believe you're on mute.
Sorry. So what's the additional fee of 50% in regard to? Is it in regard to that same fee of $350 or the increase of the $350 if it goes to $390 or $400, whatever it's going to be?
Commissioner Place.
Mr. Chair, is Roger McAden still on the line? I'm getting notes from him that pertains to a late fee if they are not registered. Their product is not registered by December 31st.
It doesn't say that. It just says if the application is a renewal application that is submitted after December 31st. Oh, I guess that's what you're saying, a late fee. That's a 50% cost. Okay, thank you.
Okay, thank you. Any further questions? Seeing none, thank you, Commissioner Place. So I've toured that lab, and I encourage anybody that hasn't toured it, when the time is right and it's opened up for tours, people should see what they do down there. It's pretty amazing. And yes, they do need the equipment to continue their work. So I guess that's about it for today. Everybody's a little more enlightened after our discussions, and I appreciate the discussions. So Senate has the gavel tomorrow, and looking forward to seeing you all then. Thank you. We are adjourned.